This program is brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you like what you hear and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.
I would like to try to give you an idea of the relationship between my daughter and me. From the day she gave her first cry into this world, she has had me jumping. I mean literally jumping to the tune of her desires, her whims, her romances, her ambitions, her longing for such things as a baby grand piano, her insane wish to live in her own apartment, when she had a perfectly comfortable home, her indomitable will to come west to study, when it could have been done so much cheaper at home. But that isn't the issue. Somehow, with her driving determination and my never-ending desire to please her and help her find her own happiness and place in her world, together we have gotten this far. We have had numerous good times and a few bad times together, but always we were together when the chips were down. And that is what really matters. That is the way I want it to always be, that we are together. My daughter is loving as a puppy one moment, fractious as an angry cat the next, riding on cloud nine when her talents and efforts are being appreciated and noticed, depressed and low in spirit and almost to the clawing stage at the establishment when she's being severely criticized. And in coping with these up and down emotional changes in her disposition, I, as her mother, am just the opposite. I am slow to anger, slow to get excited. I move slowly in making decisions, but to keep my balanced relationship with my daughter, I must shift my emotions, my directions, my decisions much more rapidly, or I would lose her completely. My daughter knows how much I care, how strong I would be for her, whether she is right or wrong. There are many material things I would love to give her, but due to circumstances, I can't. And on the other side of the picture, there are many things I have given her that she didn't want. Many times I've tried to do something for her, and she won't let me. She seems to have a protective feeling for me. She often keeps me from being foolish and extravagant by flatly saying, "No, Mother, I don't want you to do that for me." I will always give my daughter my love, my time. I will honor her privacy and give her a sincere understanding. If I do these things, she in turn will keep the lines of communication open, and I will be spared the anxiety and heartache that we see so often these days between mothers and daughters. She will know that I will treat her as an honorable, trustworthy individual, because a daughter will naturally tend to become what you expect her to be.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com. That first track was Torero Piece by Beth Anderson. And that comes from 10 plus 2 to 12 American text sound pieces. So, spring sprung last week. I was considering bursting into younger than springtime, but managed to resist the urge. There's an excellent clip of Mandy Patinkin on YouTube singing it like it ought to be sung many years ago before his role as a CIA chief in Homeland. But I'll throw in a couple of suitable tracks by Cranfield and Slade from a yellow vinyl LP devoted entirely to Sun songs. There's no lettering at all on the record, so it does indeed resemble a full Sun. All the tracks are cover versions of tracks with the word Sun in them. I'm not sure which one I'll play yet, but it should leap out from the rest of the repertoire. Also, listen out for Rodney Graham, which will also pop up unexpectedly between spoken word tracks. He, in fact, is showing at the moment at Canada House, an enigmatic exhibition called Canadian Impressionist. And trying to get into the exhibition is a bit like leaving the country. You have to sort of be scanned and have your bags sort of going through a device and so on and so on. But you get there eventually. Okay, so apart from the Rodney Graham, there will be spoken word tracks by ranters, reformers and raconteurs, three decades of spoken word on alternative tentacles. This one is volume two. The box contains five CDs plus a bonus disc, and two of those are doubles. So you get a total of eight CDs, reduced from $18.99 to $12.99 from Norman Records, including postage, limited to 300 numbered copies. So in that pack, I'll try and run through briefly, you get a sort of cardboard slipcase, and then the various CDs, which are described as featuring a variety of outstanding contemporary thinkers. Angela Davis on the prison industrial complex, Robert Fisk on war, journalism and the Middle East, Norman Finkelstein, An Issue of Justice, Mob Action Against the State, an anarchist compilation featuring Jello Biafra, Paul Krasner, Lawrence Ferlinghetti and more, and then Less Talk, More Rock, a spoken word compilation featuring Noam Chomsky, Penny Rambo and Jello Biafra again, and more, plus a bonus disc. So I'm going to start with that one, which will be a fairly lengthy one, I think, if I can manage to find it in this batch of CDs. This should be the Noam Chomsky.
There's no doubt that one of the major issues of 20th century history, surely in the United States, is corporate propaganda. That's a huge industry. In fact, it extends over obviously the commercial media, but the whole range of systems that reach the public, the entertainment industry, television, a good bit of what appears in the schools, a lot of what appears straight out in the newspapers and so on. Huge amount of that comes straight out of the public relations industry, which was established in this country early in the century and sort of developed mainly in the 20s and on, and has become an enormous industry. It's now spreading over the rest of the world, but it's primarily here. And its goal from the beginning, perfectly openly and consciously, was to control the public mind, as they put it. And the reason was that the public mind was seen as the greatest threat to corporations. That's from early in the century. Business power was strong, but it's a very free country by comparative standards, and it's hard to call on state violence, not impossible, but hard to call upon state violence to crush people's efforts to achieve freedom and rights and justice. So therefore, it was recognized early on that it's going to be necessary to control people's minds. I should say that's not a new insight either. You know, you can read it in David Hume and the Enlightenment, where it was already recognized. In fact, you go back to the earliest stirrings of democratic revolutions in England in the 17th century, and there already was concern that we're not going to be able to control people by force, and we therefore have to control them by other means. controlling what they think, what they feel, their attitudes toward one another. I mean, all sorts of mechanisms of control are going to have to be devised, which will replace the efficient use of force and violence that was available to a much greater extent earlier on, and as has been fortunately declining, you know, not uniformly, but often declining through the years, particularly here, leading to the need for other methods of control. You don't have to move very far from the Cambridge elite to learn about it. The leading figure of the public relations industry is a highly regarded Cambridge liberal, you know, Roosevelt Kennedy liberal, died recently, Edward Bernays, who wrote the standard manual of the public relations industry back in the 1920s, which is very much worth reading. Remember, I'm not talking about the right wing here. This is way at the left liberal end of American politics. His book, it's called On Propaganda, or maybe just Propaganda. I should mention that terminology changed during the Second World War. Prior to the Second World War, the term propaganda was used quite openly and freely for controlling the public mind. It got bad connotations during the Second World War because of, you know, Hitler and that sort of thing. So the term was dropped, and now there's other terms used. But if you read the literature in the social sciences and the public relations industry and so on back in the, say, 20s and the 30s, they describe what they're doing as propaganda. This manual is for the rising public relations industry, and he opens by pointing out that the conscious manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is the central feature of a democratic society. It's the essence of democracy, as he later pointed out. And he said, we have the means to carry this out now. He said, we have the means to regiment people's minds as efficiently as armies regiment their bodies. And we must do this. First of all, it's the essential feature of democracy, but also, sort of footnote, it's the way to maintain power structures and authority structures and wealth and so on, roughly the way it is. It's worth remembering something else that they usually don't teach you very much about in school, and that is, if you go back to the origins of American society, it was founded on the principle that was stated very explicitly by the leading framer, James Madison, at the Constitutional Conventions, as he put it, the primary responsibility of government is to protect the minority of the opulent against the majority. And Madison recognized, he's a smart guy, that this was going to be a serious problem. If a democratic system were established, it was going to, if people had the right to vote, he used England as his model. England was the model for democracy in those days, right? It's like, I'm talking about 1780s. And he pointed out in the debates on the Constitutional Convention something which everybody ought to read in third grade in a free society. I mean, this is the origins of our society, you know. He pointed out that in England, if they had the right to vote, which fortunately they didn't, he said, pretty soon you would find people calling for redistribution of property and for a tax on property rights for what nowadays we'd call agrarian reform. It was mostly an agricultural society. He didn't use the term agrarian reform, but same thing. He said, people will start calling for agrarian reform. Obviously, that's intolerable. And we have to protect our own society against that kind of injustice by ensuring that the rights of property prevail. He recognized that, he said, it's a problem now. He was already concerned in the 1780s by what he called symptoms of a leveling spirit. That is, people are trying to, you know, feel that property ought to be more equitably distributed. That's a danger. But he said that the danger is going to become much more severe over time as more and more people are marginalized and dispossessed and secretly yearn for a more equal distribution of life's blessings. Now, if those people get the vote, we're going to be in trouble, because it's going to be hard to protect the minority, the opulent, against the majority, which is what government's all about. And he therefore designed the constitutional system, which was intended to prevent that danger. The system, the way he set it up, he and the other framers, because it was virtually unanimous, and there was virtually no disagreement about this. The one person who might have disagreed, Jefferson, was not part of any of this stuff. The constitutional system as he designed it was supposed to put power in the hands of the wealthy, who are the more capable set of men, I'm quoting. Power must reside in the hands of the wealthy, the more capable set of men, with the general population fragmented, factionalized, dispersed, you know, in conflict, and so on and so forth. Well, this is like, we're now 1780s, okay. It's been a pretty stable system. And as it's been harder, as the franchise has increased, so over time more and more people did get the right to vote. And that just raised the danger. Furthermore, the power of the state to coerce by violence, and that includes the power of private power, like the power of, say, Carnegie to hire Pinkertons and so on, as that has declined, the need to resort to these other measures of factionalization, instilling hatred, marginalizing people, straight propaganda, and so on, that's increased, and very consciously. So by the time you get to the 1920s, where I started from, it's recognized that huge resources must go into the conscious manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses, and we have to regiment them, their minds, as well as an army regiments their bodies, and we have the methods for it, and those methods are advertising, entertainment, straight propaganda in the media, schools, so on and so forth.
Since I left my isolated, rural, and impoverished childhood in Oklahoma, I have felt like an outlaw, even in the women's movement, which I helped initiate in 1968. So I chose the name Outlaw Woman for my memoir, mindfully. Mine is not the story of a moderate feminist, a reformist. I was an extremist. My childhood icons were Belle Starr, Calamity Jane, and Annie Oakley, along with Bonnie and Clyde, Billy the Kid, Pretty Boy Floyd, Jesse James, and Al Jennings, all bandits from my part of the world. My grandfather had been an anarchist socialist, a local Western Oklahoma leader of the industrial workers of the world, a wobbly. For those and other reasons, mainly my rural working class background, my worldview was different from the emerging mainstream of the women's movement, which I perceived as being controlled by white, urban, middle class, professional women and leftist women from a similar background. From the time I left Oklahoma at 20, I have rarely met anyone who came from a background or worldview similar to mine. Rural poverty, Southern Baptist, half-breed, yet powerfully infused with agrarian populism, that is a deep mistrust for the government and for all governments, for city people, and especially for Easterners, as we called everyone east of the Mississippi and north of the Mason-Dixon line. As a teenager, I ran away from rural poverty and a violent alcoholic mother to the city, Oklahoma City, where I fell in love and married a rich boy, at least by my standards. His father was a construction superintendent. We migrated to San Francisco, where I enrolled at San Francisco State for the purpose of learning everything I could about the world, majoring in history. I was ashamed of my background and never talked about it. Got rid of my oaky accent. My husband's goal was to help me rise above my class and social status. I drew further and further away from myself and cut ties with my family. My husband controlled my every thought and action. But in 1963, I read Simone de Beauvoir's The Second Sex. The book affected me powerfully with its analysis of marriage and the family as the seed of female bondage. 3 months after I read the book, I left my husband. The following year, he fought for custody of our daughter and won. Though I had visitation rights, I paid a heavy price for my newfound freedom. Okay, so I'll move on to moving to Berkeley. New Year's 1968. I had been to UCLA for 4 years, graduate school. I moved up to Berkeley, where I was surrounded by the volatile protests and organizing around the Free Huey movement. The Black Panther Party had burst on the scene a year earlier with their black berets, street patrols, and armed with legal unloaded shotguns. I seethed over the secondary role of women and the absence of discussion of women's oppression in the movements that surrounded me. Women were to be supportive. In the Black Power movement, national liberation came first. For leftist socialism had to be established before women would be free. For the anti-war movement, draft resistors and army deserters, they came first, and they were all male. The slogan was, "Girls say yes to boys who say no." It was true. Once I spoke on women's liberation at GI Coffee House at Fort Bragg with that poster behind me, like living evidence of chauvinism. It was a very interesting experience. All the left-wing movements cautioned that women should wait. Wait for the revolution. Wait until after the Vietnam War. Wait until racism has ended.
Snitch Factory. This is a true story. A rusted-out, black-and-white police van came to a stop at the red light on 16th Street, gunning its engine. The two cops in front were staring through the windshield, with both of them wearing wraparound sunglasses. A trio of Victory Outreach Group street workers, ex-convicts, and gangbangers who were now in the service of Jesus Christ and the gospel took advantage of the idling van and ran up to the window, with the first guy yipping, "Officer! You want to buy a ticket to our church raffle? It's for a good cause, S.A." The cop riding shotgun swiveled his boulder head ever so precisely, like his neck was rolling on ball bearings. He looked at the evangelico, an overly enthused vato in a blue headband and the sagging jeans, and then he took in the man's associates, two studs who were going to fat, losing their prison muscle. "Man, I don't want to buy anything from you. I do enough," he said politely. The three vatos chuckled nervously, standing by the van's side. "Do you know what, homeboys?" the cop explained to them. "I give my everything for San Francisco. I bleed for this goddamn city. So why don't you dwarves get away from the vehicle, or I'll bust your asses for pandering." The light turned to green, and the van moved off in a gust of smoke, leaving the once-upon-a-time gangsters to cough their guts out by the curb on Mission Street.
Thank you. What we're really doing is, as I said before, it's a continuum of struggle. This is not an isolated incident. Everything is built in a certain incremental fashion. I really compare what we're doing right now to the free speech fights of the Wobblies in the early part of the century on the West Coast. That is, that free speech itself in a public arena, that in a park or whatever, was not really validated until 1930s by the Supreme Court. So, I mean, here it was, the Bill of Rights were written in the late 1700s, and it takes them over 100 and some years for the Supreme Court to say, yeah, you had this guarantee of free speech. A little long in coming, I would say. But what would happen is that when some labor organizers from the IWW, the Wobblies, Industrial Workers of the World, would show up in a town to start agitating for better labor conditions, agitating for joining the one big union, they would start speaking on a street corner, and they would be arrested by the local sheriff, who was in the pocket of the local industrialists or mining interests or timber interests, whoever they happen to be, basically local plutocrats. So then word would go out, and so within a week or two, there'd be hundreds of Wobbly organizers and speakers flowing into the town, and they would all line up at a soapbox or some sort of box they'd stand on. They would get up and say, my fellow workers, and they'd be whisked off, arrested, and they'd be arresting hundreds of people, and they'd all be all put into whatever holding facilities, and they were treated rather brutally. In the winter, they'd be hosed down with big hoses. They'd flood the cells. Some people died as a result of injuries they suffered at the hands of the local constabulary. But they would raise hell. They would sing and chant all night long. They'd keep up the whole town. They'd have to feed and, you know, house them. And eventually the average people in the town, you know, felt this was way too much of a problem to deal with. And just by sheer numbers in many towns, they were able to force, by this action of direct action, of changing the terrain so they would be allowed to speak freely on the street corners to organize and carry forth. And this is really what we're all about as a free radio movement. I see a direct lineage of that. Also, the free speech movement from Berkeley in 64. Every time people try to get up and speak and try to organize, there's always some powers to be that want to step all over you. And the same thing is true. We have to do this by sheer numbers. And the technologies are very simple, relatively speaking. It's not nearly as complicated as a computer, although it does require a certain degree of technical capacity to put a station on the air. We're trying, through different designs, to make it easier and easier as we go along. But basically, for the cost of about $1,500 or less, depending on the situation, you can actually put your own station on the air. Now, of course, the FCC will tell you this is illegal, that you can't put an unlicensed broadcast station on the air. Well, the problem is the FCC makes no provision whatsoever for low-power community FM stations. They took this away in the late 1970s, early 1980. They revoked the 10-watt community radio station classification. And it was not really revoked at the urging of the conservative political forces. Actually, it was revoked at the urging of the liberal establishment, that is, the Corporation of Public Broadcasting, NPR, Nothing to Provoke Rebellion, and those kind of folks. So there's no way under the current FCC structure for communities to have a voice. And what's really forced this issue is the FCC realizing that there are hundreds and hundreds of people on the air right now as we speak, and more going on the air every day. And that's what's important about it, that we have to, I mean, yeah, you may end up with a SWAT team through your door someday for doing this, but, well, freedom has a price.
Southern Baptists, don't get me started. And it's not, you know, all the evangelicals. And to me, the day that Bush announced his faith-based initiative, which is really just for the evangelicals, you know, I mean, it's for everyone, yeah. Let's see how many Rosicrucians get the money or whatever. I actually, Katha Pollitt had told me about the Freedom From Religion Foundation. So I got on the phone, sent my $40 in and joined it that day. Yeah, I highly recommend it. It's really a nice organization. Freedom, it's in Minnesota. Yeah, Freedom From Religion. I call myself an atheist. I know there's no God. But I'm not an agnostic. I mean, I am an anti, you know, really, I mean, that includes New Age and everything. And I have to admit that the Southern Baptists kind of do that to you. It's kind of all or nothing. They really cure you almost of any, it's like a, you know, an immunization against religion. Or I flinch when and I feel very lonely sometimes. The only other authentic, truly comrade, non-religious person I have is my daughter. And of course, she's my daughter. You know, I raised her that way. So, actually, oh, good, good. We have others. Good. Well, Katha Pollitt was speaking last night. That was very refreshing to hear her speak at Modern Times. I do think that it is still embedded in me. I've had to still struggle against the absolutes of it. There's some good things I recognize. There's what we used to call, now, mind you, my father was an atheist, a free thinker, as he called himself, as my grandfather was. But my mother, who's part Indian and raised and an orphan and raised in a reformatory. I mean, she was a street kid. She was put in a reformatory run by the faith-based initiatives. I mean, it was a state institution, Oklahoma State or county or something, but it was run by the Baptists. And she was 13 and they converted her. And of course, when she was in her 40s, she became an alcoholic. But still, you know, believing in the religion. I guess the one thing I got from it was part of what gives me a kind of anarchist sense is the sense of democracy that is a theory of the Baptists, you know, the anti-Baptists, who elect your pastor, everyone is equal. Of course, the women sit on one side of the church and the men on the other. But there's and the preachers are all cheating, you know, cheating the parish. I mean, it's all a lie. But actually, I can think of very little good. You know, I wish I'd been raised like my daughter. I really, really do, because I do feel like their mental. For one thing, the damn songs. You know, I mean, like 18 years of this. You know, I mean, "Shall We Gather at the River" and "The Old Rugged Cross" and "Onward, Christian Soldiers." I mean, too much of my brain is still occupied by this early programming. You know, so.
Chomsky said that the purpose of politics is to expose the lies, to cut away the pretensions of the past, to expose the domination and the hierarchy that is making us all neurotic messes. People ask me if I'm an anarchist. I don't know. Maybe on my good days, I am. It's hard when you're my age to not have a few days in which you do sneak around and do non-anarchist things. But the anarchist revolution that I'm learning about, not a revolution of overthrowing one set of powerful people and becoming powerful ourselves, because that's a narcissistic illusion, I think, but a way of being in the world in which we are willing to stop the music, willing to say no, willing to move to a level in which human beings can solve problems cooperatively and can resist domination and hierarchy. That's pretty exciting stuff. That's a zone that I aspire to live in. May the force be with you. Thank you.
To play piano, and we can pass the time of day, sinking in the west. Pretty soon enough, this time America's gone too far. I put my money in a foreign car. Someone show me how to turn this thing around. I'm sick and tired of the country. I wanna get a place in town. Thinking I was tough, but I wasn't tough enough. Yeah, I won't make that mistake again. A while to cave in, sinking in the west. Good to get it out of your chest.
He was pretty good to get it on. You're sinking in the rust. Good to get it on. You're just.
Thank you. cool track,
smaller.
This program has been brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you liked what you heard and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.